just with some prayer. Lord, just want to come before you this morning and ask that you would help us to learn from this biography, to be instructed, to be edified and encouraged by this believer's life. So I commit this time into your hands. In Jesus' name, amen. Today we're going to be looking at the story of Elizabeth Elliot. And our story really starts in 1926, when Elizabeth was born. Now, she was actually born in Brussels, in Belgium, to a missionary couple. And she was born in this really strong Christian home with very clear, strong Christian teaching. Her mother actually came from a very well-to-do background, but her father came from more humbler means. And soon after Elizabeth was born, she might have been a toddler, her father got a job as an editor for the Sunday School Times. And so the family moved from Belgium all the way to America, Philadelphia, where her father would work. Their upbringing, the Elliot's upbringing, well, sorry, not the Elliot's, the Howard's upbringing at this time, was very ordered and disciplined. And Elizabeth lived in this kind of routine. And her parents insisted that the children would present themselves at breakfast at about 6:59 in the morning. And every day they participated in family devotions. This was very important. And Elizabeth had a really clear sense of the importance of this time. She would listen to her father explain from readings from Jonathan Edwards, Charles Spurgeon. They would sing hymns. They would read the scripture together. She remembers that not one day of the year would they miss this time together. And in fact, she remembers going on a holiday where they had to leave at 5 a.m. and yet they had to wake up earlier because they were not to miss this time. But despite all this strictness, it was certainly not a cold upbringing. But there was perhaps not as much show of outward affection. Young Betty, as she was known to her family and friends, asked the Lord to be her saviour when she was 4 or maybe even just 5 years old. But of course there were many influences along the way. With her father's job as the editor of the Sunday School Times, it meant that they had a lot of interesting guests for dinner. And Betty remembers sitting there at the table listening to stories that came out of Africa and India and China, all these different missionaries she met during her childhood and during these dinners. She remembers particularly meeting a young lady who shared her name. This young lady was Betty as well. And she was going to be a missionary in China. And she sat there at the dinner table and they talked about what she was going to be doing. She was going to a village and she was going to work there. She was also going to marry another missionary who was already over in China. And the young Elizabeth remembered not so long after hearing the news that this missionary couple had been caught up in the long march and both of them had been dragged out of the village and beheaded. And just moments before they had been dragged out of this village, they had actually hidden their tiny baby. They had a newborn baby and they hid the little baby in a basket, pinning some money onto her jacket. And Elizabeth remembered that this woman had just been a guest at their dinner table not so long before. Well, for an 8-year-old, these events made a huge impression. And she understood very clearly from a very tender age that to follow the Lord, well, it could cost you your life. Elizabeth attended a Christian boarding school in her high school years. This was the Hampden Dubose Academy. And this particular school really did shape her teenage years. Some accused this school of being very legalistic, but for Betty, at this point, it was very helpful. This school, the students at this school loosely divided themselves into 3 groups, the MKs, PKs, and the OKs, the missionary kids, preacher kids, and ordinary kids. And here, her education was very broad. Of course, there was the usual thing, but on top of that, there was also the skills and the qualities needed for strong Christian leaders and missionaries. You see, Elizabeth learnt how to starch and fold napkins for a dinner table, but then she also learnt how to kill and gut a chicken, to build campfires. She used to go hiking, rowing, sailing. There was a lot of physical activity. But the principal's wife, Mrs. Dubose was her name, had a particular emphasis. She was a formidable woman. And one of the things she would say to the students is, "Don't you dream of being a missionary if you can't dust properly under your bed." And this was something that Elizabeth took on board. It was the attitude in the little things that prepared you for the big things. From here, it was to Wheaton College. And Elizabeth, in her high school years, had shown a particular aptitude for languages. She was very good with language, linguistics, and things like that. And so she wanted to do something with this. And there was one thing she was certain of at this time, and that was that she was going to be a missionary. It was one of the few things she was certain of. And so she combined these skills that she and what she felt the Lord was calling her to, and she decided that she would study Greek. And this, she felt, would equip her to be a translator, to really be able to maybe even translate the Bible into a language that had not been done before. And so this was her aim and her desire. From here, she went to Canada and she studied with the Wycliffe translators. But during her time at Wheaton, she met a young man by the name of Jim Elliott. Now, Jim was a really outgoing, strapping, athletic young man, but what really drew Elizabeth to him was the fact that he was so devoted to the Lord. And he also had a very clear idea that the Lord was calling him to go to perhaps bring the gospel to remote areas, to unreached people groups and so on. And he was really clear about this. Now, Betty did, of course, admire Jim from afar, but she was a very shy, reserved sort of person. And she certainly didn't believe that Jim would even notice her. She called herself a bit of a wallflower. In fact, this was something that Betty really mourned about herself. She knew that she was very introspective, a bit of an introvert, reserved sometimes to the point of coming across as a bit cold, unfriendly. How on earth could she be a missionary if everyone thought she was distant and cold and insensitive? She really wanted to work on this, to change. And it was something that she often came back to over her life. Meanwhile, Jim Elliott had noticed Betty, but he was very sure that the Lord was calling him to be a missionary as a single man, and he had very clear views that he couldn't possibly be married and serve the Lord wholeheartedly in these dangerous regions where he felt called to. In fact, he was clear that he wanted to live a life of total abandonment to Christ. In his diary, he wrote some lines that have become quite well known. He wrote, "He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." But Elizabeth and Jim were very drawn to each other. Despite being so different outwardly, in their personality, that there was a communion in their thinking. And they were drawn together by their circumstances. Jim, too, was studying Greek. He also was a roommate with Elizabeth's brother, Dave. But he was very clear that the Lord was calling him to be a missionary. So this, he felt, he didn't know what to do with this. And he felt that perhaps the Lord wanted him to lay this down, but he couldn't get rid of the feeling that it was Elizabeth and Elizabeth only. The two of them decided that they needed to pursue the Lord first. Now, this was a really lonely time for Elizabeth. She loved Jim passionately. But she was really unsure about her future because, of course, Jim was so confused and unsure about his. You know, he was so convinced about this idea that he would be a single man on the mission field. And not only that, but he had actually been encouraging other people to pursue this. He had been studying Paul's writings. He'd been encouraging his friends and telling them that they needed to do this and be unfettered, as he would put it. Well, Elizabeth cried and cried when she heard that her younger sister was going to be engaged. She wondered why it was like this for her. She felt stuck in this no man's land. You know, as Jim was poring over Paul's writings about marriage and seeking the Lord's guidance, she was just stuck. And for Jim, you know, he was wondering, is the relationship even right? Should I lay it down? Or should I get married? Should I wait? All of these questions. And all Elizabeth got was the raised eyebrows of everybody else around her. Before Elizabeth, she realized that there was only one thing she could do, and that was to seek the Lord, to continue to follow him, and continue to be trained as a single woman for the mission field. Well, it really was all quite a muddle, because the family and friends of Elizabeth and Jim really knew that they loved each other, and even Jim's friends, you know, they kind of were sort of saying to him, "What are you doing?" But soon the opportunity came for Jim to go to Ecuador. There was a new settlement being established, and he and a friend by the name of Pete Fleming were asked to go to help do the manual labor of this, just to teach in a school, to build some buildings, essentially, and all of those things. And in this particular settlement, it was kind of around the region on the western side of Ecuador near the Amazon basin. And here they would be working with the Quechua tribe, an Indian tribe there. Elizabeth, of course, had to farewell Jim again and was completely in the dark about what her future held, if their future held anything together. In 1952, Betty felt that the Lord was calling her to Ecuador. Now, there was an opportunity there which was perfect for her. It was an opportunity to do some translation work, the groundwork needed to look at a translation of the Bible into a language that had no written form. She was going to be sent to the eastern side of Ecuador, to the Colorados Indians. Now, she was very eager about this. It was a wonderful opportunity, and she was so keen to use the skills that she had learned and developed and her gifts and to do this work. But, of course, everyone thought that she was just chasing Jim, which she wasn't. During this time, she really felt that the Lord had called her, and it very much was a time of sanctification for Elizabeth. She had this idea of what missionary life would be like. She was sure that the Lord had called her. She was also sure that she was acting in selfless obedience. So there would be no reason that the Lord would not show his power, that the Lord would not grant them success, of course, spiritual success here. And she was ready for hardship, and she had no concerns or qualms about suffering. She knew that it would be difficult, but she thought that in that suffering, there would be glorious victory. All this time was anything but that. Elizabeth worked tirelessly when she got there. She threw herself into studying the language. It was a tribal language. It was difficult. And her role was really to turn this language into a written form. She needed people who could help her with this, people who could maybe who were bilingual in Spanish and the Colorados language. But it was very difficult to find someone like that. She prayed and prayed and prayed about this and asked the Lord, you know, it's your work, please provide someone. Well, the Lord did answer her prayer. And along came a man by the name of Don Macario. Don Macario was actually perfect for this. He was a believer, a recent convert. He needed a job. He was bilingual in Spanish and the Coloradus language. Of course, Elizabeth, too, had learnt Spanish, and so this was perfect. She would be able to learn the language quickly, get the vocabulary, understand it, and so on. So she thanked the Lord. The work was progressing. Well, through this man, Elizabeth made great gains. She drew up charts and sounds and had files of vocabulary very quickly. But shortly after this, Macario was farming on his farm near the settlement. And a group of men burst in and demanded the land. And Macario said, "Well, I own the land, it's mine." And so one of the men pulled out a gun and shot Macario in the head, point blank. Well, of course, the missionaries and some of the other workers heard the shot, came, and saw Macario lying dead in a pool of his own blood. They wrapped him up in a poncho and brought him back. The horror and injustice of this shook Elizabeth to the core. Such a random act. And these people that came out of nowhere and just shot him before he could even hardly say anything. It was so senseless. Why had the Lord allowed it? The one person who could speak Spanish and the Coloradus language, the work was just started, it was progressing. And of course, now it came to a grinding halt. Betty really struggled to understand the Lord in this. A letter soon arrived from one of Jim's friends, the fellow missionaries who were working in Ecuador. And it indicated in this letter that Elizabeth should come to Quito. And she should come there to meet Jim. Well, Elizabeth's heart skipped a beat. Could it be that after all this time, Jim had finally come to peace with the idea of marriage? Could it be that he was about to propose to her? Well, she made the long, arduous journey from the eastern side of Ecuador all the way to Quito, one of the main cities there. And there they stayed with another missionary couple, and Jim arrived, and Jim did propose to Elizabeth at that point. It had been 5 long years of uncertainty. 5 years. And they were soon to be married. So after a few days of bliss in the city of Quito, Elizabeth made the long journey back to the Coloradus Indians. Now, she knew that her time was limited. She would be moving away very soon. And so she worked feverishly. She wanted to really establish the groundwork for this language to enable the Bible to be translated. And so she worked and worked. And of course, she had some understanding of the language, but she had to try and work it out herself now. She didn't have anyone who was bilingual. So she worked to record the vocabulary. She sorted out everything. She had all these files. She labeled things. And when it was time to leave, she packed everything up neatly into one suitcase. One suitcase with hundreds of cards of vocabulary, sound charts, everything the missionaries who would be staying there would need. All the groundwork, she felt, was done. And she had done it with a lot of effort. Now, not long afterwards, Elizabeth moved to another mission station. She had to learn the Quechua language. She was going to be moving over to the western side where Jim was. And so, of course, she needed to understand the Quechua language, this new tribal language. And so she'd moved to another station in order to start studying this language. While she was there, she received a telegram from one of the missionaries from the Coloradus region. And they told her that that suitcase full of all the language work that Betty had worked and labored so hard over had been stolen off the back of a truck. All the work was gone. Well, Betty couldn't believe it. She just couldn't understand what was going on. Like, how could it be that one suitcase was stolen? It was that one. How did the Lord allow this? Two random acts, she felt. The senseless murder of Macario first, and now this. And in fact, everything that she had done amongst the Colorados Indians, it seemed, was a waste. It was all for nothing. Later, Betty would reflect on this time as a time of really good but hard training. She had learnt an important lesson about God's sovereignty and how she really needed to learn humility. And of course, she had known it in theory, but now she knew in practice that God's ways are certainly not her ways. Once married, Jim and Elizabeth moved to the Puyapungo Indian region, and they threw themselves into their work. There was, of course, a lot of physical work. There was building work to be done. In fact, Jim built a house for them. Elizabeth taught in the school, but she was also trained in midwifery, so she delivered babies. She treated snake bites. She helped with any sort of infections, gave injections, etc. And the Indians, the Kichwa Indians, really accepted them wholeheartedly. They often provided them with food from the hunt, you know, an armadillo leg, a bit of manioc or, you know, smoked fish, a bit of monkey, that type of thing. And they really did try and fit in with the tribal life. They learnt to trek through the jungle. You know, Elizabeth remembers running barefoot through the jungle to deliver a baby. And they really worked on understanding the Kichwa culture as well. Shell Oil Company had attempted to set up a settlement. They were, of course, looking for oil. They had wanted to set up this settlement in the Amazon jungle. But where they were setting it up was very close, if not into, the tribal lands of the Warani people. Now, this was a fierce tribe, a tribe really known for their violence. The Kichwa Indians feared them. Soon, many of the shell workers were being speared to death. You know, the Warani people would just emerge from the jungle and descend on them and disappear. And soon, Shell ended up having to abandon the settlement. And the Ecuadorians themselves, they wouldn't go. They feared these people. Nate Saint was one of Jim's friends. He was a pilot for MAF, or MAF, the Mission Aviation Fellowship. And his job was to fly supplies to different remote outposts to check on missionaries, etc. And he'd actually been told to avoid flying over this particular part of the Amazon jungle. And the reason for that was because if there was something wrong with the plane and he had to make an emergency landing, well, he would just be speared to death. That's what he was told. All these stories of the Warani people made Jim really think about the idea of reaching them with the gospel. And he was really drawn to these people. He wondered if it would somehow be possible to make contact with this tribe that no foreigner had ever managed to make contact with and survive. Well, it wasn't just Jim. There were three missionaries who shared this, who really prayed to the Lord about the possibility of reaching these people. And in fact, it was five of them in the end that worked together. Five missionaries that kind of banded together and discussed how they would manage to show them that the white man was actually friendly, that the contact that they were going to make would be peaceful. And they came up with this idea. They did actually have one person who knew something of the Warani language. This person was a lady by the name of Dayume. Now, Dayume had run away from the Warani tribe, escaping from some internal trouble. And she had run to a farm and ended up working there as a sort of a servant on the farm. So she knew something of the Kichwa language and, of course, the Warani language. And so she taught Jim and some of the other missionaries some phrases, some "we come in peace" type phrases. But also they needed to do something for the tribe to show that they were going to be peaceful in their contact. And so they came up with the idea of flying the plane. Nate Saint was going to fly the plane low. And he had already spotted where the settlements were. They could kind of see it from the air. And they decided that they would drop gifts onto the shore of the river there and hopefully in this way show that they were coming in peace. Well, soon they were doing these regular flights, and this is over many months, regular flights over this particular region where they knew that the Warani were, and they would drop things like axes, aluminium pots, all sorts of things. And soon they were sort of lowering things on a rope and a bucket. And the Warani people soon came to expect the gifts. They would actually run out, the children would be there, they would be looking, waiting for the plane. And so it was really progressing well. And then soon the Warani people were taking what was in the bucket and also putting a gift in. They had some hand-woven headbands. On one occasion there was a parrot, a live parrot that was given to them. So this was very promising. It was like the Warani were understanding that this was positive contact. These people were wanting to come in peace. Now, Elizabeth was just as excited as Jim, and she really wanted to be involved. In fact, she argued that her involvement would be a good idea. You know, as a woman, they would understand that, you know, that there's no kind of fighting here. They're not going to come in violence. Surely her, as a woman, would be able to send that message. But Jim wouldn't hear of it, especially now, because in 1955, they had a little baby girl by the name of Valerie, and Elizabeth needed to care for her. Now, after several months of these gift drops, the men decided it was time to make contact. And this would be a historic moment. They were going to land on a beach, which they nicknamed Palm Beach. This was a beach fairly close to where the Warani were and their settlements were, and they could see that from land. The men had, of course, a radio so that they could contact their wives at the mission base. They had been praying for this moment for months and months and months. Everything went to plan. They landed, they set up their camp, and just in a few days, two Warani men and two Warani women emerged from the jungle, and they approached the camp. And of course, Jim and the other missionaries, with their well-practiced phrases, they said them over and over again, trying to kind of make sure that there was a clear understanding that it was all peaceful. And these four Warani people, they came, they shared the food, and they were very happy. They, in fact, slept at the campfire overnight. And there was no evidence that they were angry or violent or anything. In fact, quite the opposite. And so it was very promising, and they thought that the Lord was answering everything. All their prayers for this point, to this point, were going, everything was as they had hoped. The next day, the four Warani just disappeared into the jungle. Now, of course, the men were really sure at this point that they were going to come back again, but probably with more people and probably with, you know, maybe the tribal members or key people from the tribe or something. They had no way of really knowing, of course. But it had been such a positive contact. Well, that morning, Nate Saint flew the plane again over the jungle. And he noticed that there were some men moving through the jungle. And they were headed in the right direction. And so he radioed back immediately and said, you know, I'm seeing people moving, they're coming towards us. They'll probably be here by this afternoon. You know, today is the day. Today we are going to make contact with this tribe. Well, this was transmitted back to the mission base as well. And the five wives of the five missionaries also were joining them in prayer. And the men said that they would radio back at 4:30 that afternoon. Little did the missionaries know that the two men who had gone back to the tribe had completely lied about this contact with the foreigners. They hadn't said that it was a friendly contact. They had just lied about it, saying that these five foreigners wanted to kill them, etc. The reason they did this was to shift the blame from some internal dispute, something completely unrelated. They just saw an opportunity to shift the anger of the tribe onto the foreigners for their own personal benefit. So when Nate Saint saw the men running through the jungle, they were coming not peacefully. In fact, they had planned an ambush. They were coming in a fury, a frenzy. And so when Jim and the other four were waiting, and finally they actually saw the two women that had come previously walking towards them out of the jungle, of course, Jim hopped up straight away and he ran towards them, shouting the practiced phrases and trying to gesture and show their welcome, etc. And Pete as well, and Pete Fleming also was with him, and they were running towards them. And then, when they were close enough, men came out of the jungle, at least about five men with their spears. And Jim was speared first. And then, within minutes, all five missionaries had been speared to death. Now, by about 3:30 in the afternoon, the men had been speared repeatedly, as was the Warani custom, to the point of being unidentifiable. The plain had been completely ransacked and ruined, and the Warani themselves, they disappeared back into the jungle. Now, the women waited all afternoon, and some of them were getting quite nervous as 4:30 went past. But it didn't worry Elizabeth. She was just thinking that in the excitement of the moment, they'd forgotten. They'd probably hear later at night. When they didn't hear later that night, and there was complete silence on the radio, they did start to worry. And the next morning, when there was still no sign and no message on the radio or anything, they were very worried. And soon another MAF plane came, and they charted it over the area where they knew that the men had set up camp. And when the plane flew over and saw the wreck of Nate Saint's plane, they knew something had gone wrong. They quickly organized a rescue mission. And soon, of course, when they came onto that area, the Palm Beach area, they discovered all five bodies, identified only by shoes and items of clothing. So, Betty was now a widow. And she had a little girl, 10 months old at this point. She'd been married just over 2 years. Why had the Lord allowed this? Well, Betty had absolutely no answers at all. She had already learnt to lay everything down. And she had learnt, as Amy Carmichael, who she really respected, another missionary, she'd learnt that, as Amy Carmichael famously said, that being a missionary was a chance to die. And she really understood this as, of course, not physical death, but the everyday death, the everyday laying things down. And in her journal, Elizabeth wrote, "God has arranged it thus, so it must be." Elizabeth realized that she had lost her most precious possession in Jim. And with his death, all their plans of a future together, you know, they had talked about how they would serve these Indians that they were living amongst in their home in Shandia, how they would bring up their family. They wanted to have more children. In fact, they had even discussed that if they had another little girl, her name would be Evangeline. All of this that she had looked forward to for so long had been taken away and completely gone. But strangely, she had no hate for the Warani, and she recognized this as something very odd. She prayed a prayer that the Lord would actually take her to them, that she would be able to do something for them. And at the time, she thought, this is an absurd prayer. Well, everyone had their opinions about what she should do, and the other four widows. You see, all of this had played out in the headlines in America as well. And so they were getting, you know, letters left, right and centre. Everyone had their opinion. Everyone had their opinion about what happened and what went wrong. But everyone felt that Elizabeth should go back to America. It just wasn't right for a single woman to live out in the jungle. She'd be the only missionary in that area, in that where the Kichwa tribe is around Shandia. She'd be the only one. And then she had a young daughter as well. Surely it was not appropriate. But Elizabeth really wanted to stay. And she really wanted to continue with the people. In fact, you know, Jim, the last thing Jim had said to her was, if I don't come back, teach the believers, darling. We've got to teach the believers. And she took that to heart, and she decided that that's what she would do. Well, she continued her work, but as she continued on in Shantia, she soon realized how much there was to do. Suddenly, without Jim, it was overwhelming. She had to manage workers who were doing this building work. She had to manage wages. There was also the airstrip, which needed to be constantly cleared. She had to run a diesel generator. There was a half-done hydroelectrics as a system that she had no idea about. And then, of course, she had to run the school. She had to deliver babies, treat snake bites and all of the usual things. But also, she had to teach every Sunday because she had to teach the Kichwa Indian men because they were to speak on Sundays. And she didn't feel she could assume this role, so she had to teach them the scriptures so that they could speak and teach their own people. On top of that, there was the half-finished translation of the Gospel of Luke that she and Jim had been working on. And of course, she had to look after a one-year-old. Well, everything just felt like a weight. And she felt impatient at times, hugely restless, and then at other times, extremely overwhelmed and intensely lonely. Sometimes her days were consumed by such menial daily tasks that she wondered why she was even there. And on other times, she actually begged the Lord to take her away, that she would die. And thinking, she really felt at times that it was impossible. It was impossible to continue without Jim. How could she? But it was at this time that she learnt a really hard lesson and another good lesson. She wrote, "Sometimes life is so hard, you can only do the next thing. Whatever that is, just do the next thing, and God will meet you there." But as the months passed, she started to see great fruit amongst the Kichwa Indians she was living with. You see, the men would preach, and very simply, but people were coming forward. People were wanting to know the Lord Jesus. People were hungry. And soon they were baptizing more and more people. And then they were hungry to know more of the Lord. And this hadn't actually happened before. And Elizabeth realized that the Holy Spirit was really at work amongst these people. Now, Elizabeth did return to America for a short while, a season. And this was because she was asked to write a book about the five missionaries and what had happened. And this book, some of you may have heard of it, is called Through Gates of Splendor. Well, the minute she finished that book and it was all through to the publishers, etc., she decided that she would return to Shandia with Valerie. Well, she'd coped with so much already. You know, the shock and the sudden loss of Jim and, of course, all the other missionaries there. The other four missionaries. And on top of that, you know, the grief and the hard work, being alone on this Kichwa settlement, all of that she'd coped with. But now there was another test. It was a huge test for her, and certainly not one she expected. When she returned to Shandia, the house that Jim built had been occupied by another missionary family. They'd been living there. It was a big enough house, and it ended up that Elizabeth and Valerie were able to live in the same house. They were able to have a room, etc., from in this house. But living with this family just brought Elizabeth to her knees. This family was messy and completely disorganized. They had no care for the things, the furniture and all the things that Jim had so lovingly made. And the last straw for Elizabeth? Well, the husband would clean out his ears with a bobby pin at the breakfast table. And that just brought her to the edge of herself. The careful, disciplined, stoic, reserved Elizabeth really, really struggled at this point. She had coped with all those other things, but this was just too much. She wrote in her diary, "Oh, the loneliness, the utter, vacuous, vast, inconsolable, irremediable loneliness of my position. It was too great. Oh, Lord, take me out of here." So through this seemingly petty domestic situation, the Lord revealed even more of himself to Betty. And she really did realize that she had not laid down everything for Christ. And soon she decided that she would let the family have the house that Jim had built, and she moved away with Valerie. But for her, the future was still very much a blank wall. In her mind, she was still very clear that the Lord was calling her in some way to do something with the Wurrani people. She really wanted to go to them. But how was she just going to go to them? She certainly couldn't just walk into the jungle and just present herself. It would have to be by some miracle. And why not, she thought. The Lord uses weak things. And she certainly felt that herself, Elizabeth, and her little daughter Valerie qualified as weak things. Now, there was news of the Wurrani tribe's movement. In fact, there was a missionary by the name of Dr. Tidmarsh who had a hut nearby, an airstrip which they were working on. This airstrip was very close to the Wurrani lands. And on one occasion, the Wurrani just appeared out of the jungle and completely destroyed, ransacked the hut, tore up books and everything. They left two cross spears at the door and disappeared back into the jungle. Thankfully, Dr. Tidmarsh was actually not there at the time. But this did nothing to deter Elizabeth, all these stories. In fact, her family felt that she had some sort of suicidal tendency or something with her desire to actually go to this tribe. But Elizabeth was really clear that this must come from the Lord. And so she prayed more and more, "Here I am, Lord, send me." And then, the miracle. It was 6 a.m., November the 13th, 1957, almost 2 years after Jim's death. Two women walked out of the jungle and approached a Kichwa settlement. The surprised Kichwa Indians immediately recognized them as the Wurrani and offered them food and shelter. And these two women came, and they didn't look like they were in any hurry. They weren't passing through. They came, they stayed, they slept, and they seemed in no hurry to move on. Now, the news spread quickly, and Betty happened to hear this news by chance. She was actually visiting another missionary at the time. And the news came to this other missionary who was only a few hours away from the Kichwa settlement where the women had appeared. And Betty, who just happened to be there, heard this news and immediately grabbed her things, a tape recorder, anything that she had with her, and she decided she would make the journey to meet these women. Well, when she got there, she immediately recognized the older lady. The older lady had been the same woman who had emerged just those 2 years before when the missionaries had camped on the beach. She recognized her because Jim and the other missionaries had actually taken photographs. And so they had this photograph, and it was very clear that it was the same woman. Well, the women were in no hurry to move. In fact, it looked like they'd moved in. And so Betty decided that she would move Valerie and that they would actually live in this settlement here and stay with these Wurrani women. She thought it would be the best opportunity for her to at least learn some of the language and get familiar with it. And this was a very exciting time. She felt a huge weight of responsibility. The task of learning this language was formidable, but she thought that this was obviously orchestrated by the Lord. After she'd settled in, that very next morning, she decided that she was just going to wash Val in the river, little Valerie. And so she was just bathing Val there in the river, when suddenly the Kichwa men came screaming and running, and they were screaming, "Wurrani, Wurrani!" And so, you know, Elizabeth didn't know what was happening. She just grabbed Val and they ran through the river, and she didn't know where she was running or anything. And then they realized that the Wurrani had just emerged from the jungle, and they had speared one of the men, a young man by the name of Honorario. They'd speared him 22 times and then abducted his young wife. This was horrible. And when Betty saw the body of Honorario with the spears still sticking in him, it suddenly brought back to her all the emotion, the raw emotion of that moment when she knew about Jim and his spearing. And seeing this mutilated body, it just made her want to run away. She suddenly was overcome. She felt physically sick. She needed to run. She needed to get out of there. She just wanted to leave and forget it all. Well, she had learned by this point that she needed to lay everything down. And so she prayed that she would be able to lay down this raw emotion, this instinct that was rising in her. And she asked the Lord, "If you want me to stay, it will have to be by your grace that I'll be able to remain." And she did. Now, the Wurrani people at that time were really, there was not a lot known about them at all. This was the late 50s, and this tribe had really been isolated for centuries. In fact, their language bore no resemblance to the other tribal languages. They had a particular way of dressing with the particular tradition of the ear holes with the balsa wood in their ears. And they were semi-nomadic, so they did do some farming, but they could move on instantly. The violence within the tribe was so high that many people thought that they would actually cause themselves to become extinct. That's how high the homicide rate was. You see, disputes were just dealt with through spearing. And the casual nature of life and death was just a part of life as a Wurrani tribesman. Of course, they hated the foreigners, they feared them, and they were encroaching on their hunting grounds. The tribe themselves very much lived in the present. They didn't have a religion or anything. They had some spiritual ideas about the origin of life, but they lived in the present. Of course, they had to hunt every day for food and so on. Their shelters were very simple, could be erected in a day and taken down in a lot less. They just lived such a simple life, very much in the present. In fact, you know, even the idea of mourning for someone who died a month ago, why would you? They're dead, they're gone. And that was how they lived. Now, Elizabeth really struggled at this point with the waiting. These two Wurrani ribbon women who had just come into the Kichwa settlement, and they didn't seem in any hurry to go anywhere, and of course the communication was impossible, and no one could really tell what they were doing there, why they'd come, how long they were going to stay, what was going to happen. And Betty did try so hard with the communication, trying to learn the language, but it was difficult when there was no common language there. And of course the Wurrani didn't understand what Betty was doing, and so they were completely indifferent to her. Now, Dayume, the Wurrani woman who had escaped to a farm years before, came to meet these women and actually recognized them and knew them. And through these women, she found out information about her family members and so on. And Dayume decided that she also wanted to go back. But with Dayume here as well, because Elizabeth understood the Kichwa language and Dayume could speak a bit of the Warani language and the Quechua language, suddenly Elizabeth was able to communicate a little bit and start to learn the Warani language. Soon the women were talking about leaving, and they wanted Elizabeth to come with them, to go back to the tribe. And so Elizabeth tried to establish and said, "They killed my husband. Will they kill me? Will they kill Valerie?" And the women said, "No, we will share food with you. We will carry Valerie over the jungle trails, and we will tell the tribe. We will tell them that you are our mother, and we love you." Well, Betty wasn't sure that that was going to be the case. How could she know? But she did feel that this was an opening. So eventually, two missionaries, Elizabeth, and of course, little Valerie, and Rachel Saint, the sister of Nate Saint, decided to make the journey with these women into the Warani territory and meet this tribe. This would be definitely historic contact if they were able to survive. Of course, their ultimate mission was to bring the gospel to these people who had never heard it, and also to learn the language in order to perhaps even translate some of the Bible into their language. But Elizabeth knew that there was no assurance whatsoever that there would be any sort of physical protection from the Lord. Of course, think about what happened with Jim. Now, Betty clearly had a gift for language, but so did her 3-year-old daughter. And her 3-year-old was imitating the Warani language, the songs. She was able to speak it perfectly. She was picking up words daily from all the other children and so on. And Betty and Rachel were accepted in the tribe. They were kind of not particularly welcomed. They were often laughed at. They were a source of amusement to the tribe. But there was no sense of violence towards them. Betty worked hard trying to record the language. She took a lot of photos during this time. And everything that they did was under the scrutiny of the Warani people. You know, the houses that they lived in had no walls. And people came and went as they pleased. You didn't sort of have your own space, per se. And as Betty wrote in her journals, there were often people, you know, watching her. In fact, she would wake up sometimes and find that people were watching her as she slept. They would laugh at her as she washed Val's clothes in the river. They thought it was just such a waste of time. What was she doing? Washing the pots, washing these clothes. It just seemed so silly. And Elizabeth herself felt like such a waste of space. She couldn't cut the manioc, she couldn't get firewood, there were so many things she couldn't do. And these were things that the Warani children could do. Well, there were times when they realized that they really were a burden. Val herself had become very much at ease amongst these people. But Betty and Rachel found that, you know, that perhaps they were a burden to them. You see, the Warani, they needed to hunt for food. And now, you know, Betty and Rachel, they couldn't hunt. And so the food was shared, of course. But there were times when the hunt wasn't good and the whole tribe just went hungry. And so Betty and Rachel decided that they would need food dropped in by the plains, the Maff plains. And of course Val would need milk and so on. Well, the tribal people thought this was most amusing, and they would put their fingers in the food and sniff at it, often in disgust, at things like oatmeal and coffee. Dayume, who has joined the tribe again, and now much older, she wanted to share some of the Bible stories that she had learned from Rachel Saint with her tribal members, with her family, essentially. But this was very strange because, you know, the tribe was not used to this idea of one person talking and everybody listening. The idea of praying and all this was so foreign to them. But the people were actually willing to hear, and they were willing to listen as Dayume told them about this man, Jesus, and what he did. And gradually, the people were taught from the Bible. It was very difficult getting the concepts through. I mean, obviously the language that they had was so connected to their immediate jungle culture. They simply didn't have words for things. But Elizabeth looked on in wonder as the Lord did work amongst these people. And these hardened warriors, these hardened men, some of them decided to give up this violent way of life, their spearing. And they talked about how Jesus was speared for them and how they now wanted to follow his jungle trail. Now, Betty wasn't given ever to triumphal statements of success or anything like that. And she realized that the concepts that these people had were hazy at best. But she did feel that the gospel had come to the Warani in some way, because she could see the fruit of it in their lives. While she was there, more of the story of what happened on the 8th of January, that afternoon in 1956 with the five missionaries, came out. And this is when she kind of found out that the whole reason for their death was completely senseless and nothing to do with the missionaries themselves, but more to do with an internal dispute. And she marvelled at the fact that here she was, sat around a fire, sharing a roasted monkey claw with the very men who had speared her husband so brutally. One of the men, Minkaye, called her one day and said, "I killed your husband. I didn't live thoughtfully then, but now we know. Now we think about God. Now we will not spear anymore. You are now my younger sister. Your mother is my mother. Will you tell them that I call them family?" And of course, Elizabeth said, "I will tell them." The gospel had borne fruit. Now, life in the Amazon jungle was anything but romantic. It was mud, it was bugs, it was snakes, it was hunger, and complete lack of privacy, the strain of communication. Of course, Elizabeth was learning the language fairly quickly, but it was still hard, and they were often laughed at. But the biggest struggle for Elizabeth at this time was the extreme loneliness she felt. You see, her relationship with Rachel was a very rocky one. The two women were very, very different and very strong individual women, and they had very different views and ways of working. Rachel herself believed that she had a clear vision, that this was her calling, to come to this tribe and to live with them for the rest of her days. She didn't welcome Elizabeth's presence there at all, and she really didn't want to accept Elizabeth's help with language, even though it was very obvious that Elizabeth was far more gifted as a linguist than she was. This was a constant struggle for Elizabeth and a huge thorn in her side, and she prayed and prayed about this relationship, but they really had no fellowship, and Rachel didn't even seem to want it. And although Elizabeth wanted reconciliation and wanted things to be right, it seemed like Rachel had no desire for this either. It was, to Elizabeth, it was just so strange that the two of them were so foreign to each other, more foreign to each other than they were to the Warani people. Well, their differences were also very much manifest in the way they taught the people. For Rachel, you know, she, for example, wanted the people to wear clothing for modesty's sake. But Elizabeth felt that this was not necessary. The heart issue of vanity was not there. These people had no concept of thinking about outward appearance at all. They didn't dwell on it. Details like this led Elizabeth to really examine what is Christian and what is just culture. And were they actually bringing more avenues for sin on these people by insisting on their civilized Western ways? But soon even 4-year-old Valerie was asking Mum if they could leave. But through these life lessons that Elizabeth learnt, She understood that obedience happens despite your feelings. It was obedience that was important. And if the Lord wanted her to stay, and if there was work for her to do, then her emotions, her feelings were not a factor in this. But she began to feel increasingly useless, with Val's expanding mind. You know, there were no books, there was nothing for her, and the living conditions were very difficult. And Rachel was simply not allowing Elizabeth to do any of the language work. Were it not for the conscious presence of Christ, Elizabeth felt that she would actually descend into insanity. And during this time, she was very much encouraged by reading the biographies of other missionaries who'd gone before her, people like David Livingstone, Mary Slessor, Adoniram Judson. And she recognized in them the same feeling, this idea that if it were not for the presence of Christ, they too would have descended into madness. But she knew God had not forsaken her. And so she continued on and did the next thing. But after 2 years of living with the tribe, Elizabeth made the difficult decision to leave. This, if you look in her journals, this was a really hard time for her, of a lot of self-examination. Was she doing the wrong thing by leaving? Was she blind to some of the flaws in herself? And she was actually worried sick by this. The stress of it was overwhelming. Now, Elizabeth really did admire Rachel Saint. This woman had unwavering persistence. She was faithful in her teaching and so on. And Rachel really believed that she would live out her days here, and she didn't want the help of anybody. And Rachel did live out her days with the Warani people. But the last blow for Elizabeth was that she found out that Rachel had told the Warani that Elizabeth and Val were leaving because they were angry with them. Elizabeth was really hurt by this, and she really prayed to the Lord to allow her to forgive. So her departure from the Warani people was completely inauspicious. In fact, few of the Warani expressed anything. She and Val just packed up their few possessions and walked out. They went to live with the Kichwa Indians in a nearby settlement, where she was going to figure out what on earth she was going to do next. She wrote to her mum in a letter at this time, "I find that faith is more vigorously exercised when there is no satisfying explanation for God's ways." The two of them did decide to return to America. And through these experiences in Ecuador, Elizabeth really realized that she had this subconscious idea. This idea that the obedience to God, you know, takes you to a destination, and there, once you're there, everything will flourish. But now she realized that a life of obedience never comes in for a landing. She wrote, "He leads right on, right through, and right up to the threshold of heaven. He does not say to us ever, 'Here it is,' but rather, 'Here am I, fear not.'" After she made the decision to leave Ecuador and return to America, Elizabeth felt a strong sense of peace. This was the right decision. She had been in Ecuador over 8 years now. And on that very last night, when the home she was staying in was packed full of the Kichwa people farewelling her, she took a moment to withdraw to a corner, and she wrote in her journal. She quoted from Isaiah, "I, the Lord, have called thee. I will be with thee." And then she wrote, "Lord, you have kept your word." When she returned to America, she settled into a new life with her daughter there, and she wrote many books that had been burning in her during her time at Ecuador. She was asked to speak constantly, of course, and at this time with the rise of feminism, she often debated feminists. She wrote about this particular issue. She spoke mainly to university students. And then, to her great surprise, she fell in love again. And she married a man by the name of Addison Leach. She didn't ever think she would get married again. But here she had found a soulmate, a best friend. And finally, she settled into married life with Addison. But soon after their marriage, Addison was diagnosed with an aggressive cancer. And so Elizabeth found herself nursing Addison. And of course, he ended up passing away just after just 4 years of marriage. Elizabeth found herself again alone. Now in her late 40s, she had learnt many lessons along the way, and so she just continued on. And she continued speaking, writing, teaching. She began a regular radio show called Gateway to Joy. Now Elizabeth would marry a third time, 4 years after the death of Addison. And her latter years were also quite difficult for her, but in a different way. This gifted speaker, writer, linguist, lost her language altogether as she struggled with dementia. And in 2015, at the age of 88, Elizabeth Elliot passed away. But what a legacy this faithful saint has left us. Her varied experiences and the hard lessons that she has learnt, many of which are recorded in her 25 books. And of course her radio program, which is now a podcast, these continue to encourage and instruct people. And now there are many believers amongst the Warani people, although the tribe itself, of course, is not as isolated as it was before and a lot more westernized. And there is, of course, a Bible translation in the Warani language, and that was finished in 1992. Betty's obedience throughout her time as a missionary did not lead to stunning results that she could see. And you know, there were many opinions about her husband Jim's death. Some people saw them as impulsive young men who barged in there with no understanding of culture. Other people saw them as heroes, as martyrs. Other people saw it as a waste. Well, one question that she was so often asked in America when she was on speaking and so on: why do you think the Lord allowed Jim to die? For her, this was a really irrelevant question. She had personally learned not to ask why, but to ask what. Lord, show me what you want me to do, and in that acceptance I will obey, and there is peace. Her journals and her letters show that she was so aware of her own personal flaws, her failings. She often wrote about her impatience, her sharp tongue, maybe her insensitivity, her stubborn nature. But what she also wrote was that the kingdom of God is like leaven and seed, things which work silently, secretly, and slowly. But there is in them an incalculable transforming power. Even in the plainest soil, even in the dullest dough, lies the possibility of transformation. And I think from our standpoint, we can be so encouraged to see the Holy Spirit's work in a fellow believer. A fellow believer who is willing to obey Jesus and simply do the next thing. We are going to sing a song to finish. And the song we're going to sing is number 49, Find Us Faithful. And I certainly feel that the lessons and the life of Elizabeth Elliot are in fact a stirring testament to God's sustaining grace. And I hope you can join me in singing this song. And after this song, of course, there is, as usual, the virtual morning tea. So please feel free to join as well.
encouraging the weary. Elijah's stirring testament to God's sustaining rest. Surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us run the race not only for the prize, but as those who've gone before us, let us leave to those behind us the heritage of faithfulness passed on through godly lives. Oh, may all who come behind us find us faithful. May the fire of our devotion light their way. May the footprints that we leave lead them to believe.
Yeah, it's finished, yeah?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I just want to get my stuff.
Oh, no problem.